continuing our discussion of the worship of the church, and we're talking about lower Christianity. You know what I mean by that term? Somebody define lower Christianity. What is lower Christianity? Worship of, at least in a sense, of what? Objects that are less than God, which drove in the period of the Imperial State Church down to 604, 323-604. Come now to worship of pictures and images, and again, this is not divine worship, this is not lutria, but prayers are offered in this period. Prayers begin to be offered to saints. I've already said prayers were offered, originally prayers were offered for saints who were martyrs, primarily. Now they're offered to saints, four men. And saints are often represented by pictures. Consecrated candles are burned in their honor. This comes into the practice of the church. In some countries and in some periods, this has taken the form of genuine idolatry. So whether this, the veneration paid to pictures and images is not divine worship, but in some cases it has been almost that, or has been that in some areas. Yes, there are shrines, usually of some of the Holy Family sometimes, or Mary or Jesus or some of the saints, but they would insist that they do not pay worship to these, and in most cases they don't, not divine worship anyway. It is veneration and devotion in some areas, and some, you know, sometimes in some places it has been worship, one of the more superstitious expressions of Roman Catholicism. Well, to come now to the worship of relics. Now, a relic, by definition, in the beginning, was a part of the body of a saint or an article which has been in contact with the saint. You see, keep in mind, originally these saints were martyrs. Those who died up to 323 died in the persecution. Many famous saints, famous martyrs. Remember, the days of the anniversaries of their martyrdoms were commemorated in the church. Then this evolved, and they would take the bodies of the saints, usually the bones of the saints, dig them up, and if they were buried, and distribute these to the churches. It became a religious fetish. It was an extension of the cult of the martyrs, as we've said. It is explained as an intimate reminder, a natural sentiment of veneration. That is, if you had a part of the body of the saint in your possession, then this was an intimate reminder of to imitate the devotion of that saint. It was in, Roman Catholic Church explains this as a constant visible reminder to that we should have faith like that person had faith, and then it went from there. They were used as protection for cities, still are, by the way. Aroused a great deal of criticism, both from within and from without. Pagans thought it was obscene to cut up bodies and distribute them, and many of the church fathers agreed. Much fraud developed. These came to have value attached to them, and sometimes you had more saints, more parts of the bodies. Had some three-legged saints, saints with 20 or 30 toes. And this has continued down through the Middle Ages. It's been remarked that there was enough wood from the cross floating around Europe to build the Ark, 50 cubits long and 30 cubits wide. This comes down to our period, the practice has become that every altar in the Roman Catholic Church, which is consecrated for the celebration of the Mass, must contain a relic. Do you know that? Every altar in the church at which the Mass can be said must contain a genuine, authentic, certified relic.
That including America?
Including America. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean the part. There are many, the relics now go beyond just the parts of the bodies of the saints. But we're going to see this when we come to the beginning of the Reformation. A lot of fraud and superstition concerning, you know, you have twigs from the burning bush, milk from the breast of Mary, and even the horns of Moses, little horns. Yeah, I'll talk about that later. Yeah. Well, anyway.
Did the shroud tomb use the body bread?
The Shroud of Turin is a relic. Of course, that doesn't mean it's not. It is used as a relic, yes. Go back and read the King James. Look up, I'll figure out exactly what the citation is. Where the language appears, the horns of Moses. It's not literally. You can look it up. It's a bad translation. But they didn't know in the Middle Ages, so they had little horns. Have you seen statues of Moses? Have you seen the horn statues of Moses with horns?
Yeah, horns.
No. I forget the exact citation. You can look it up. I wasn't prepared to talk about this. But you have in Europe a statue showing Moses with horns. Come from a mistranslation. You can look up horns in the King James Concordance, and you can find it for yourself. Well, the theological basis of this was first suggested by Jerome. That is, honor. Now, this is the Jerome suggested this, and this is what the Roman Catholic Church teaches today. That honor given to the servant is automatically transferred to the master. And they cite the statement of Jesus, he who receives you receives me. So they say, well, this honor and veneration, in some cases worship given to the saints, is really worship given to God automatically, just sort of built into the system. As far as the worship of angels, it was never as important as saint worship. But there is the concept of the guardian angel, which corresponds to the patron saint. Now, the concept of a guardian angel is more scriptural, by the way, than the concept of a patron saint. Well, I don't have time to talk about that. I'm going to just very briefly look at Christian art and architecture. I include this under worship, although it's only indirect. I didn't want to make a separate section for it because it's not that important. But insofar as art and architecture enters into worship, we would discuss it here. Art, we've already said, began to develop after Constantine because of the surge of the building of church buildings. When the church was not illegal anymore, they began to put up buildings. We know we've already established that. And art had two purposes. First of all, simple decoration, beauty. The classical world was much given to the use of art. You should know that. But secondly, it had a more pragmatic, utilitarian function. And that is education. And there began to come in this period, and it was really developed in the Middle Ages, the practice of putting Bible scenes and art. Later, this was transferred to windows. You have the Bible scenes pictured in stained glass, which were simply an elaboration of the original practice of Bible scenes painted on the walls. And often they would put scenes in sequence. You can go to some churches and find different progressive chronological sequences from the life of Christ portrayed around the stained glass windows. Well, they would have pictures and also some of the trials of the martyrs, that kind of thing. And it constituted, as I say here, a theology in pictures. And it was used for centuries when it was transferred to stained glass windows as well as art, and it was extended to stained glass windows. It became a theology in pictures. It was used to educate the uneducated, those who could not read and write. And see, the Roman Empire is slipping into its dark age now. More and more people who are illiterate. The pictures help. It's like a child's picture book, you see. You take a child, give them a picture book, and they can learn, even though they can't read the words. Concerning pictures of Christ, if you're interested, in the 4th and 5th centuries, there appear the first pictures of Christ in church buildings. But they are idealized. They're ascetic. Christ, you have basically two Christs. You have the calm Christ, and you have the suffering Christ. Kind of two basic themes that were followed. But in any case, Jesus has always appeared as an ascetic, because asceticism is the ideal. Lean, very lean look, frail, usually. Well, when we come to architecture, we're by now able to think in terms of the East vis-a-vis the West, and two kinds of architecture developed, respectively. Byzantine architecture in the East, named for the Byzantine Empire, and I give you a little hint of that in your syllabus. It emphasized the dome, the large domed roof. And then the Basilican in the West, by the way, St. Peter's in Rome is a basilica. In fact, you heard it, St. Peter's Basilica. Basilican architecture makes heavy use of pillars, heavy use of pillars. So you would have more open space in a Byzantine building than you would in a Basilican building. That is uncluttered floor space. If you're in, I just put that in. We don't have time to discuss that, but if you're interested in that, you can see that this is developed. And by the way, you go to the east. If you travel in Europe and you travel in the Middle East today, you still see this distinctive architecture. You still see you can still distinguish even buildings built in fairly recent times, Byzantine architecture from Western or Basilican architecture. You can always tell a Byzantine building. Well, if you're interested in pursuing that further, you can. We come now to the leaders of the church, and some of these we've already looked at, so I'll talk more about the others. Eusebius of Caesarea. This is the famous Eusebius, his famous history of the church. I give you the years here, 260 to 340. He is called the father of church history. I think he's right. He was a contemporary of Constantine. And Eusebius is important for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that he has preserved, by his quotations, many ancient documents otherwise lost. As he had them, he cited them. We don't have them, but we know what they said from his citation of them. He was the bishop of Caesarea. In the Nicene controversy, he took the middle ground and tried to reconcile the Arians with the Orthodox. One of his most famous works is he delivered a panegyric of Constantine at the emperor's death. What's a panegyric? You were just about to ask me, were you not? A panegyric is a document written to eulogize somebody. It's a slanted biography. That is, if you want to hear a panegyric sometime, just go to a funeral service. You hear, they tell about the life of the person, they tell all the good stuff, and forget the bad stuff, which is just as well. I hope they do that in my case. It'll be short that way. But this is what he did. You see, Constantine, what I'm saying is when Eusebius finished this brief biography of Constantine, the Constantine you meet in Eusebius' work is a better man than the real Constantine. That's what's called a panegyric. Now, his most important works I list here, the Ecclesiastical History, Chronicle, Life of Constantine, that's the panegyric, and Martyrs of Palestine. Well, that's Eusebius, and we should certainly know who he is. We come to Athanasius the Great, and we've already met him. Remember the Nestorian controversy? He was the hero of the other side in the Arian controversy, and I refer you back to page 81 of your syllabus if you want to review that. You recall that he was the Bishop of Alexandria, and he was the theologian who, with the help of the three Cappadocians, was able to bring harmony between East and West. You recall that by not insisting on the word homoousion. His important works I list here, I'm not going to read those. You can just have, that's for your own information. That's all I'm going to say about Athanasius, because we talked about his most important contributions in our discussion of the Arian controversy. This brings us to the three Cappadocians, and I'm also going to just refer you back to page 81, because their importance has already been discussed, and you can, I put them here because you could not make up a list of the important leaders of the church in this period without including them, but we discussed them under another heading, okay? So I'll just make reference back to that. We've already met the three Cappadocians. Which brings us to John of Antioch. John of Antioch was one of the more colorful characters of the period. He's also called John the Golden Mouth, John Chrysostom, one of the great scholars and great orators of the Imperial State Church. This is the church in this period. John, as a young man, felt the call to the ministry. Thought he did anyway. But he resisted it. He became a monk, a very austere monk. In fact, he damaged his health for life by his extreme asceticism, his very keen sense of God. Finally, he gave in to the call, as he thought of it, and became a preacher at Antioch, where Paul went out from, Antioch of Syria, and he was a great preacher. He was an excellent orator, He preached exegetically. His commentaries, some of them are still available, by the way, are very readable, very good commentaries. He was a real barn burner. In fact, his popularity spread, and when, this is quite a story, the most important bishop in the East, of course, would be the Bishop of Constantinople, just like the most important bishop in the West was the Bishop of Rome. You see, the center of the capital now is in Constantinople. And the bishop there was a very wealthy, very powerful man. When he died, when the bishopric became open, the people in Constantinople wanted. It's like sometimes you find this where you have a big church. Sometimes big churches get to be proud churches. The pulpit comes open and they want the most famous preacher available to be their preacher. That kind of thing. And one of the most famous preachers, perhaps the most famous pulpit man in the world at that time, was John of Antioch, or John Chrysostom. And so they asked him to come and be the bishop of Constantinople, to control more wealth and power than the Bishop of Rome, but to certainly have the highest seat in the East, the highest ecclesiastical seat. And he didn't want to come. He said, I'll stay here and I like my present ministry. I'll just stay here. And finally, they kidnapped him, literally. They kidnapped him, took him to Constantinople and said, we want you to be bishop. They went and got him. When they appointed a pulpit committee back then, they really did it right. John, he figured that was the call of God. You know, he that was about an open door. That was it. So he decided he'd become the Bishop of Constantinople, and he did. Well, then the trouble began. First of all, he offended the clergy of Constantinople. You see, he's very wealthy. He has a lot of money attached to that office. And they had this big mansion, and the bishops in the East, in the lesser clergy, made it a habit to go to Constantinople at the drop of a hat. I have to go there on business. You know, these business trips, like our congressmen take these junkets to all over the world just to look in on things. They would come for consultations. But one of the reasons they wanted to come to Constantinople was a very wealthy city. A lot was going on, and they, according to the protocol, they stayed with the bishop. He, in this big house, one of the reasons he had a big house, he put up the bishops, fed them. They were used to sleeping in soft beds and having all kinds of good food and entertainment, just having a great time of it. They were very immoral, and most of them. But John, what he had done, he had written a menu, and it was a monk's menu. And he stepped on the floor and continued his monkish kind of life, which y'all had. He was an ascetic. Well, that's fine for him, but when these other bishops showed up, he expected them to do the same thing. And now you can imagine how that went over. He objected to their immorality. He said, to use our language, he said, most of you are nothing but a bunch of pimps, which is what they were. Some of them were sleeping had a harem. They were very immoral, and everybody knew it. And he said, okay, you want me to be bishop? You wanted me to be your bishop? I'm your bishop now. But when he came down on them for the immorality, and he wouldn't entertain them lavishly, they turned against him. But when you get the preachers against you in town, you're in trouble. But that wasn't enough. Then he offended everybody else in town. He attacked the luxury, the games, the profligate way of living. He was very critical of the immorality of the rich. He made the mistake of criticizing the women. You can't ever do that and survive very long. He criticized their dress, their cosmetics. He went into great lengths about the attempt to dress and paint yourself and try to look young. He didn't like that. He was single. and he criticized the way they would flaunt themselves around town. In short, he just alienated all the women in town, just about. There were some, not all of them, but most of them. So, and then he preached what we would call a social gospel of kinds. He was ahead of his time. He was a great man, by the way, in that context. For instance, he blasted the rich because they were oppressing the poor. He came out against slavery. He came out against equal rights for women, believe it or not. You know, on one side, he was condemning them for their worldliness, as he would say it. But on the other side, he condemned their oppression. You can imagine a man way back then coming out for the equal rights for women, but he did. And so And he made a habit, for instance, he would sell expensive church possessions and give it to the poor. Some guy, one bishop was building a big church building. He ordered really expensive marble pillars, and John, as the ruling bishop, he just sold them and went out and built a church building for some poor people who didn't have a church building. So he defended the clergy, made everybody, just about everybody else, made the public mad. And then it didn't bother him. He just preached away. Then he got the court mad at him, got royalty mad at him. You see, when he was preaching, it didn't bother him that the emperor and the empress were in the crowd, and they were. See, that was every Sunday they would go to church, have to go to church, and here's John preaching there in Constantinople every Sunday, and he just leveled his gun, and whoever was there, including the king and the queen, or the emperor and the empress. You can imagine how that went over. And the queen finally, because she was very, especially the queen was very worldly, the empress, and so finally they couldn't take it anymore. He lost his job. The queen had him banished, sent out of the empire. He was just on his way out of town, and a terrible storm came up. Lightning flashed, and the queen, the empress, thought this was maybe a judgment of God, so she had him called back before he got very far, and she canceled the banishment. And so he rewarded her by preaching a sermon on Herodias, and everybody knew who he meant. You know Herodias? New Testament, and he just blasted this Herodias, and he did all but name her. I mean, you know, here he just gets back from banishment. You got to admire the guy. He had some guts anyway, didn't he? He just gets back from banishment, and his first sermon is, he did on Herodias. And everybody just said, here's the queen sitting there in the crowd, you know, and he just blasting away, and he was right what he said. But boy, with that, she banished him again, and this time no storm came to his rescue. And now he had a very popular following. See, don't get the impression everybody was against him. There were a lot of good, godly people who followed him, and he had a great deal of influence. And the queen didn't like this, so she couldn't just have him put to death. That'd be bad form. So she had him banished, but she instructed the soldiers, the guard who was in charge of him, to keep him, to make as hard for him as they could. They banished him first to the area of Armenia, the northeastern part of the empire. I don't have my map pulled down, but it was very cold, very hot in summer, very cold in winter, and she made sure that she saw to it that he froze through the winters. And he was a very austere man anyway. An ascetic doesn't do well in cold weather because he doesn't eat much. And yet people, some of his followers, his disciples you might call it, they kept traveling. He still had too much influence because of the people who loved him and followed him. So she had him sent farther away, finally up into the areas of the Black Sea, and the soldiers just mistreated him. And for instance, they couldn't kill him. But what they would do is if they would be traveling, and if it came a real bad day, real cold, they'd make sure they traveled on that day, you know, and marching through the snow and make sure he didn't get much to eat, because he wouldn't eat much anyway. And finally, Chrysostom, died in September of 407, just sort of took him so far away that he died in exile, he died alone, and he has been canonized by the church, but looked upon as one of the great leaders of this period, and he was. He was a godly man who wasn't afraid to do his job. Yes. No, it just sort of, there was no group, no church starter, you know, had no organized following, just those who loved him. And by the way, you see, this serves as a commentary on the moral situation in the church in that day, the fact that this kind of thing could happen. John of Chrysostom was a very good and godly and sincere, honest man, and I think much to be admired. And so is the next man we're going to look at, Ambrose. We have met Ambrose before. Who was Ambrose? Where did we meet him? Yes, but where did... Remember, who was it that converted Augustine? Who was the great speaker that Augustine went to hear and had many of his intellectual problems solved? It's Ambrose. So we've just touched on him here. Now we're going to look at him in some detail. Ambrose was a prefect. That is, he was a leading civil officer, something like a city manager in the city of Milan in northern Italy. He was not a churchman. And Milan served as the seat of the empire in the West. This was a period, during some of this troubled period, the capital of the West was not always in Rome, and for a while it was in Milan. That's a whole other story. But he was an important figure in the leading city in the West. The bishop of Milan had died, and the church was having trouble over agreeing on his successor. In fact, a riot was about to break out, and Ambrose entered the cathedral as a civil officer. Found that? He was not even a Christian. He was a catechumen and hadn't been baptized yet. He was studying to become a Christian. But he was a good man, and he went there to keep the peace. So here's the church just about to have, church fights are old, and here in a church fight, who's going to be bishop? And it was very important. But there were political parties and factions. There was a lot of wealth attached to it, a lot of power, and so it was not a very spiritual business. And so he went in, and according to the story, when he walked in, he's not even a Christian yet, a little child cried out, "Let Ambrose be bishop." And the crowd kind of picked it up, and they couldn't sell anybody else, and they weren't too happy with their candidates. And, here's Ambrose. Everybody respected him. He was a great man. And so they said, "Yeah, let Ambrose be bishop." And he didn't want to be bishop. He's like John Chrysostom and Constantine. No, he didn't want to be bishop. But they just prevailed upon him, and he believed in God, and he sort of felt like, well, maybe this is what he ought to do. It was the will of God. So, true to his character, he decided if he was going to be bishop, he was going to be a bishop. So he was baptized and went through the level. He was baptized and ordained ordained a deacon, ordained a presbyter, and ordained a subdeacon and a bishop. And he got in a very short time, just in a few days, he went from being a non-Christian to being a bishop. He went through the ceremonies, which was sort of a legal formality. And he decided he's going to be a bishop, And so he was a bishop, and he was a good one. He was extremely intelligent, became one of the great bishops of the ancient church. He was a great theologian, as I point out here, one of the founders of Latin theology. He was the one whose tremendous argument, he's a tremendous speaker, and a brilliant mind, convinced Augustine of many things. And to indicate his sincerity, he was a very wealthy man. He sold his estates and gave his gold to the poor. All of his life, he was greatly concerned about the poor, as Jesus was. But you see, you get a man like this, you believe him, don't you? When he impoverishes himself for the poor, then you believe he's really concerned for the poor. Without getting into politics and making anybody mad, but that's why I have never believed the Kennedys and their concern for the poor. They've always been willing to give the poor my money. But when's the last time they gave the poor any of their money? You find this is characteristic of East Coast liberals, where liberalism is very. You find the wealthy, most extremely, who are really concerned about the poor. Often it's the wealthy, liberals, like the Kennedys, concerned about the poor, except that they tie up all their money in the tax-free foundations, and they pay less money to support the poor. They work it out so that their money stays in their own pockets. And the poor get less of their money than they get from the average taxpayer. Do you know that? Yeah. Well, you see, I said this back in the 60s, and when the Kennedys politics, but I just said this. If I'll start believing the Kennedys if they're so concerned for the poor when they give some of their money to the poor. Okay. And maybe I'm cynical in my old age, but. You see, that's like a lot of these cult leaders. They talk about concern for the people, but anybody that manages to become a millionaire out of the business of caring for the poor and the downtrodden and caring for people's spiritual needs, I just don't trust them. Maybe I'm cynical, but I just don't. I trust Ambrose. He put his money where his mouth was. He was vastly wealthy, and he gave it all away. Right? You see? Well, and I got that window into the soul of the man. He also took up the life of the ascetic, but you remember this is an ascetic age. This is an age where it was just accepted that the godly life was the ascetic life. He ate very little, much like Chrysostom, much like Augustine. He devoted the greater part of the night to prayer and study. Had great personal power as a result of this. He addressed the continuing problem of the relation of the church and the state. Now, keep in mind, this is the age of the imperial state church, we're calling it. Now, you understand there was no church called the imperial state church. That's a historical classification. What's happening to the state? The state is disintegrating, becoming less and less organized, having more and more problems, more and more bureaucracy bound. What's happening to the church? Becoming more and more powerful, gaining more land because of the idea of penance, penalties paid for keep out of purgatory. Church is becoming increasingly powerful, and the church and the state are using each other. They're becoming functionally one, and trouble is coming out of this. The continuing problem, who's in charge, the church or the state? Ambrose, who was a statesman before he was a bishop, understand, he was a civil, he was in politics, in government, before he was a bishop, set forth three basic principles which became the guiding principles for the church in the West and are still followed by the Roman Catholic Church. I think you ought to know these. It's a good test question. First of all, he established the right of the church to protection by the state from both heresy and paganism, that is, the true church. Now, this principle, of course, assumes the unity of church and state. It is the job of the state to protect the church from anybody, including heretics. The Jehovah's Witnesses come to town, you call the sheriff. Well, they didn't have any Jehovah's Witnesses back then, but they did have. They had Arians. They had the same view of Christ, and you find somebody's an Arian, you turn him over to the government. The government's job to put him to death, or put him on trial at least. You got that? That is to protect the church from everything, including heretics. That is the true church, the one holy Catholic Church. Secondly, the independence of the church from the state in its own realm. That is, the state must protect the church, but not get the idea that it can control the church. In other words, if the state is to protect the church, has this responsibility under God, but cannot interfere with the life of the church, if the emperor is notified by Ambrose that he's not the head of the church, who has preeminence, the church or the state? The church does. So first of all was the right of the church to protection from the state, but there are also the independence of the church from the control of the state. That is, the church is in effect saying to the state, you must do what we say, but don't ever try to get us to do what you say. We represent God, we represent the sword spiritual, you represent man, or the government, the sword temporal, and God is always over man, therefore you must do what we say, but we are not subject to you. The third principle was the supremacy of the church in the moral and spiritual realm. Of course, the problem was, the kicker in that was, that who decides what is in the moral and spiritual realm? Well, the church decides, and what the church did systematically was that anything it wanted to stick its fingers in simply declared a spiritual matter. In this area, the emperor had to bow to the authority of the church. Well, Ambrose wrote this up and presented this, and the church accepted it. But how about the emperor? What did he think of this? Well, the emperor Theodosius, he got into a mess and ended up testing whether Ambrose and the bishop or the church in general could pull this off or not. He enraged the city of Thessalonica. He was enraged at Thessalonica. A riot took place. Now keep in mind, the empire is disintegrating. Riots are happening everywhere. When you have the ship sinking, you have a mutiny, you've got to put it down harshly. Right? You just can't afford that in a disintegrating situation. So Theodosius, the emperor, caused many thousands in Thessalonica to be put to death. And he didn't bother to separate the innocent from the guilty. Well, Ambrose, you can imagine what he thought of that. Ambrose wrote a very polite letter to the emperor saying, Dear Ted, love you dearly, and next time you're in town, come by and have supper. Oh, by P.S., you're excommunicated. that's not what he said, but it was a very polite letter. Sending him to hell. That's what excommunication means, if he didn't repent. I give you an excerpt from this very, this is hilarious, Ambrosio, he writes a very nice, funny letter. Now, later on, you're going to have popes, because Ambrose wasn't the pope, but you're going to have, was the Bishop of Rome, but you're going to have popes excommunicate emperors, and they're not nearly as nice as Ambrose was. You say nothing personal, you say. He says, on top of page 103, I give you an excerpt to show you the tone of this. I, indeed, though a debtor to your kindness, you've been very good to me, and for which I cannot be ungrateful. That kindness which has surpassed that of many emperors has been equaled by one only. In other words, there's only one man, emperor, been more kind than you have. I say, have no cause for a charge of contumacy against you, but I have cause for fear, and I dare not offer the sacrifice if you intend to be present. I love you dearly, and I appreciate all you've done for me, but you're excommunicated, and if you show up to church, I won't say the mass. Because you can't say the mass with a heretic, with an excommunicant present. Well, Theodosius, polite or no polite, he didn't like being excommunicated. Who's Ambrose think he is, excommunicating the emperor? However, it stuck. Ambrose pulled it off. Because, as a matter of fact, because of the reasons I've given you, I hope you understand what's going on, Ambrose had more power than Theodosius did. By now, the spiritual power, as they would call it, was more, because, you see, Theodosius was the emperor over a crumbling system. Ambrose represented the authority that could send a man to hell for eternity. In other words, we're going to see this all through for several centuries. This is the story which recurs time and time again through the Middle Ages. Who do you fear most? Who does the average person fear most? The king or the bishop? Well, what's the worst thing the bishop can do, or the king can do for you, to you? He can put you in jail. He can send you to jail or take your life. But the bishop, he can say the word and send you to hell for eternity. We got to understand the lifespan. Death came very sudden in those days. If you lived to be over 30 years old, you'd beat the actuary table. And you understand, in other words, people died quite suddenly. They died of all kinds. They died of very ordinary diseases. When life was very tenuous, you would choose to obey the man who could excommunicate you before you would obey the man who could simply put you in jail or kill you, because you might die soon anyway. And so Ambrose simply told the people, said in effect, either you, Theodosius, either you shape up, or I'll just tell the people that you aren't the emperor anymore, and if they don't do what I say, I'll send them to hell, and then where will you be? And he wasn't the first, he wasn't the last, though. He was the first, but he's not the last emperor to find himself in this position. Now we're going to see that in some situations, in some ages, the Roman Catholic Church couldn't always make that stick. But it stuck this time, because the church was more powerful than the empire. Ambrose demanded, does that make sense to you? I'm dealing in very general terms, but it's quite an interesting story. It's hard for us to think about it because it's so far removed from the kind of world we live in. But Ambrose demanded that Theodosius make public confession of his sin. Now think about it, here's the emperor, has to get up in church, he's up there in the cathedral, and confess he's a dirty, rotten sinner for killing all the innocent people in Thessalonica. And he said, if you don't, you will not receive the Lord's Supper. You won't get the sacrament. If you don't have the sacrament, you don't get grace. You don't get grace, you can't go to heaven. Well, Theodosius held out for a little while. But finally, he couldn't. And he also, he believed in hell. He believed in the power of the bishop to keep him out of heaven. So Theodosius finally made his repentance and was restored to the grace of the church and the friendship of Ambrose. Ambrose never did get mad at him. He said, now you understand, this is not personality, this is principle. And he and Ambrose were great friends the rest of their lives. he said, well, you just made a mistake, you had to pay for it. But you see, what Ambrose was doing was establishing a principle. And he did it. The last statement in this discussion is this. This is a very important event in the history of the church and the empire. What event? When Theodosius gave in, made his public confession, received his absolution, was restored to the fellowship of the church and the friendship of the bishop. It was the first instance of a sovereign acknowledging his subservience to a law higher than his own, and of a bishop successfully extending his authority over the conduct of an emperor in an area considered by the church to be the moral realm. This was the setting of a precedent. And boy, we're going to do business with this again, as I've said. Fundamental issue. For instance, we come down in the Reformation, the next quarter of the Reformation period. Look at Henry VIII of England. Sort of looking at the landscape ahead. Quite interesting. How did Henry get around this? You know, he simply, rather than getting this mess of conflict between the church and the state, he declared himself the head of the church. took both offices in one. You know, solve that problem. The Pope says to Henry, "You must obey me, or you can't go to heaven." And Henry said, "I'm not so sure about that." Well, why would Henry say that? Why would Henry tell the Pope, in effect, to go jump in the lake? I'll make myself Pope in England. Which he did. Why would he do that when Theodosius wouldn't? Well, things had changed. Things had changed, and we'll see how they've changed. But now, in this age, Theodosius really had no choice. And so Ambrose pulled it off. And it's a precedent that's going to come back to haunt the church and the empire for many centuries to come. Well, we've got 5 minutes left. Let's look ahead to discussion 21. You haven't done the reading for this yet, but we'll go ahead and begin and get as far as we can. We don't waste any time. The next great leader is Jerome. Page 109. Jerome. I'm sorry. I've got numbered differently on this copy. You're right. Sorry. 104. Jerome, the year is 340 to 409. Let's not do that. Jerome, we need to talk about him in one chunk, because he's the author of the Vulgate, and he's a very important character. So, any questions? Yes.
Do you think that we know that Augustine was the lieutenant with Ambrose before or after the deal that Ambrose had with him?
I do not know. It's a good question. I don't recall the chronology in that. Probably not. He was interested only in his preaching, its rhetorical abilities and his arguments. He went to Augustine wasn't interested in the other side of it. I don't know. It's a good question. I'll look that up. By the way, you might want to check. You get the Sentinel Star today. The reflection section, not the religious section, is in the Little Sentinel. And they got an article written by the Roman Catholics this week, and I thought you might be interested to see some relevance to some of our discussion. In one statement, I found out that we talk about Mary serving as a patroness of cities, same way the pagan gods did. Mary, as a matter of fact, is the patroness of Orlando. And I didn't know that until I read that. There's a statement in the Sentinel Star, a Roman Catholic priest commenting on the Mass, and he doesn't use the term the Roman liturgy, and that's fixed. I urge you. It's not an assignment, but I think it'd be in a lot of what we've been discussing. Pardon? Are you going up?
No.
Well, I can't. But I urge you to get the Sentinel Star today. Look at the Little Sentinel. It's not very long. It's two brief articles. You read it in 4 or 5 minutes or less. Written by two Roman Catholic writers on this subject. And I think in a lot of our discussion, you might find it particularly relevant. Interesting. We're dismissed. Have a good weekend.